This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
War and peace and the Democratic Party. Hello again, I'm Marvin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. As President Bush struggles to regain support for Iraq, the death of former Senator Gene McCarthy brings back memories of another unpopular war. McCarthy's challenge proved that Vietnam made Lyndon Johnson vulnerable in 1968, making the anti-war movement part of America's political history. On To The Point, as Democrats prepare for upcoming elections, where does the anti-war movement stand now? We'll talk about John Murtha, Joe Lieberman, Hillary Clinton, and the party's liberal base. On Reporter's Notebook later on, can global warming be slowed in time? First up, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. The late Senator Gene McCarthy's opposition to Vietnam legitimized the anti-war movement in American politics. On To The Point, in the midst of another unpopular war, where's the anti-war movement today? What are the opportunities and the risks for Democratic candidates? On Reporter's Notebook, scientists are alarmed at foot-dragging over global warming. We'll get two reviews of the UN Conference on Climate Change. First, this news update. After his third speech designed to bolster support for war in Iraq, President Bush stunned the crowd at Philadelphia's World Affairs Council by taking questions from the audience. Here's a bit of his speech.
As more Muslims across the world see this, they're turning against the terrorists. As the hope of liberty spreads in the Middle East, the terrorists will lose their sponsors, lose their recruits, and lose the sanctuaries they need to plan new attacks.
President Bush is speaking today at the Philadelphia World Affairs Council, of course, just a few days before the next election in Iraq. Warren Veith covered today's appearance for the Los Angeles Times. Warren, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Big surprise when the president answered questions, and he got some that required responses, which he gave. One of them was, how many Iraqis have died in the war? Not a figure that the administration puts out on a regular basis. What did he have to say?
He said that by his best estimate, about 30,000 Iraqis had been killed in Iraq. White House officials later told us that that was not an official government estimate, that it was sort of the best available compilation of what's been reported publicly elsewhere. But it's the first time ever that the president had provided any kind of estimate of the civilian casualties.
He was also asked very directly by one of the people in the audience, why is it that you keep making a link between September 11th and the war in Iraq when, as the questioner put it, no reputable reporter and nobody else apparently the questioner thought was reputable thinks there's any connection? How did the president answer that one?
Well, he didn't answer it directly. He started off by saying that that September 11th had changed his view of the world and how it works, and that he went on to get to say that the military offensive in Iraq was very much part of the overall war on terror. But it was a somewhat oblique answer to the question.
Watching on television, it appeared that the president was, however you judge his answers, extremely confident, very much at ease, happy to be taking questions from a crowd, which were not obviously screened in advance and not necessarily to his advantage. What was the reaction in the room at the World Affairs Council?
Well, we were cordoned off to the sidelines, so we didn't have the opportunity to actually talk to people afterwards. But it was a receptive crowd. By the administration standards, though, you're very right. This is a very unusual kind of situation where he takes unscreened questions from people that aren't, you know, pre-selected, in effect. I don't think he's ever done that in the context of discussing Iraq, and he rarely does it in addressing any subject.
Hard to tell then at this point whether the White House thinks his performance was a success. We'll have to wait for that. We're talking with Warren Veith, who's White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. President mentioned that Philadelphia is the cradle of American democracy and the Constitution. I wanted to make that connection to the Iraqis and their vote coming up on Thursday. It's also fairly close to where the very conservative, military-oriented Democrat John Murtha is located. Was there any connection made there?
The president did not mention Murtha. Murtha had a press conference after the president's speech, which we were not able to attend from here. But he's very much the president trying to counter the criticism from people like Mr. Murtha, who contend that the original decision to invade Iraq was a mistake, and that the administration's continuing refusal to withdraw troops is just compounding the problem.
And, of course, Mr. Murtha has stunned the Democratic Party. We're going to be talking about this later on our program by his calls for setting his timetable and getting out as soon as possible. The president's poll numbers appear to be up slightly in recent days. Does the White House think that that's because of these speeches?
The White House thinks that they have played a part in that. It's not a huge blip upward, but it's certainly possible that the administration's effort to be more more forthright, perhaps, in its discussion of Iraq might play a role in that.
Again, looking at it on television, it appeared that the president was very upbeat today. You weren't close to the audience, but you're experienced at seeing the president in these situations. Did you think he did seem to be sort of on his game?
Through most of the speech, yes, he was animated. He was emphatic. He was candid in his responses for the most part to the questions that were asked. He very much looked like someone who was eager to tell his story and to tell it in more detail than before.
Well, as always, Warren Veith, thanks a lot for being with us.
Certainly, thank you.
White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. In a moment, war and peace and the Democratic Party on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. As President Bush tries to rally support for the war in Iraq, many Americans are mourning the death this weekend of former Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota. In 1968, McCarthy challenged a president of his own party in the midst of an unpopular war. His success in the New Hampshire primary led to Lyndon Johnson's announcement that he would not stand for re-election. Stephen Smith is professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
McCarthy didn't win the New Hampshire primary. He got 42% of the vote compared to Johnson, who got 49. Why was that regarded as such a stunning event, and why did it lead to Johnson's withdrawal?
Well, of course, the polls were showing that the war was becoming more and more unpopular, but it was a big shock to the president and many across the country that in his own party he could come about even in the first major primary event of that election season. You know, McCarthy went on to win four more primaries, and I think the Johnson people knew that if he couldn't beat McCarthy by more than that in New Hampshire, a relatively conservative state, that he'd be in deep trouble later in states like Wisconsin, Oregon, where McCarthy actually won those primaries.
All this resulted, of course, in one of the most tumultuous years in American political history, as somebody wrote this weekend in the Los Angeles Times. Robert Kennedy got into the race, appeared to be on the road to the nomination, then was assassinated in California. The result was Hubert Humphrey became the nominee. What did that do as far as the peace movement and the anti-war movement was concerned?
Well, McCarthy helped crystallize the anti-war movement and helped legitimize it within the Democratic Party. There were Democrats in the mid-1960s, before 1968, who were critical of the war, but who really held their fire because it was their president, after all, in the White House, and it didn't serve their partisan purposes much to attack him. McCarthy, early 1967, decided really to come out strongly against the war policy and became really the first U.S. senator, major Democrat, to take on the president of his own party. So he became the lightning rod for his party. His demeanor, his professorial nature led people in the Johnson administration really not to fear him very much. So it was a big shock that he was able to actually put together a campaign. We attributed a lot of this to his own personality and his anti-war position, but you know, he put together a dandy campaign, an on-the-ground, door-to-door, massive campaign in New Hampshire. And that's what really, really shocked Johnson, that he could actually be out-campaigned by someone, and he was.
MacArthur described himself as an accidental instrument of the anti-war policy. He's a very amusing guy, very literate, wrote poetry, that in some ways appeared to get in the way of the standard kind of behavior that you would expect from a political candidate. Of course, the upshot was that the Democrats didn't win.
Well, you know, it was both an advantage and a disadvantage. The advantage was that he was unassuming, self-deprecating. It appeared that he wasn't himself personally ambitious, that at least to a lot of people who followed him in the mid-1960s. In fact, he was a fairly ambitious politician. He would have liked to have been Johnson's vice presidential nominee in 1964 and, in fact, tried hard to get that, ultimately deferring to Hubert Humphrey. So there was that side of him, and he was a very popular fellow, great sense of humor, tall, handsome, 6'4". Kind of forget that he was a successful politician. On the other hand, he didn't like an awful lot of the glad-handing of politics. He was very smart. He prided himself in being a maverick. That was a part of his image from the very beginning. And in 1968, after Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, there was an opportunity for McCarthy to pull together the anti-war forces and go into the convention with a real shot at winning that nomination. Many, even in his own campaign, blame him to this day for failing to take advantage of that opportunity. Some said he went away sulking after Kennedy stole the mantle of the anti-war movement from him. Others say his heart was never really in running for president. He wanted to lead a movement, not actually run a presidential campaign. Whatever it was, he did seem to miss an opportunity. He was missing an action. And then ultimately, you know, it took him forever to endorse Humphrey. At the time of the convention, he did not endorse Humphrey. And Humphrey later wrote that he thinks that if McCarthy had pulled the anti-war forces behind his campaign, he could have beaten Nixon in 1968. So there's a lot of mixed feelings about McCarthy among anti-war activists of that era.
A lot of other things going on, of course, at that convention. One of the most violent in American history, with what was later described as a police riot outside, with the Chicago Police Department being involved with anti-war demonstrators trying to influence a convention. And, of course, at that time, too, the primaries weren't important, despite what we've said about the history of New Hampshire and so on. There were also there was a lot of power on behalf of political pros in the party. They had a lot to say about who got the nomination as well. Again, Professor Stephen Smith teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. Our next guest is Michael Crowley. He's a congressional reporter and senior editor for the New Republic magazine. He's written what he calls A Zoological Guide to Democrats on Iraq for this week's issue. And Michael Crowley, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to ask you to go into detail on the zoological metaphor that you use, although let me tell our listeners, it's very amusing. But let me ask you this. Is there now on the horizon in the Democratic Party a sort of anti-war legitimizer like Gene McCarthy?
Well, two people come to mind. One is the fellow I described in my story, stretching the metaphor to possibly absurd proportions, as a climate-altering asteroid event. That would be Pennsylvania Representative John Murtha, decorated former Marine, who sort of grabbed center stage in this debate just before Thanksgiving, calling for a withdrawal from Iraq as soon as is feasibly possible. Murtha has no sort of national political ambitions, so the closest thing to an anti-war catalyzer I can think of right now is Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, who was really the first sort of major Democrat to call for a withdrawal plan back in the summer. Since then, actually, the debate has moved so fast that he's not so extraordinary, but he may actually be the only Democrat considering running for president who voted against the war back in the fall of 2002.
Very few Democrats did vote against the war, or maybe I'm overstating that. Certainly not a majority, am I right?
Well, it was different in the House and then in the Senate.
Okay.
In the Senate, I believe there was not a majority, but as far as those with great national ambitions and thoughts of running for president, right now it looks like Feingold may be the only guy who does it. So the anti-war movement is very happy with him right now.
Okay. Again, Michael Crowley is with the New Republic. We'll come back to him in a moment. Let me turn to Tom Matzie. He is Washington director of the liberal organization MoveOn.org, trying to make a grassroots impact on the Democratic Party. And Tom Matzie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Perhaps I shouldn't isolate you as entirely Democratic. I think you may not have political affiliation as MoveOn.org. Am I right about that?
Well, that's true, although most of our members are Democrats.
Okay. What do you think about the prospect for the anti-war movement now in the Democratic Party?
Well, I don't know if it's a – I wouldn't characterize it as the anti-war movement anymore. I think it's the anti-war public, and that's an important distinction to make. We've moved from, the people being opposed to the war being a minority now to being, 60-70% of the public, depending on the poll. Last week's New York Times survey showed nearly 60% of Americans support an actual hard timeline to get out of Iraq. So it's the anti-war public now, and there's a real opportunity for Democrats to show that they're in step with the public. If they can bottle that spirit of John Murtha, like Michael Crowley was talking about, that will be a big advantage for them in 2006. We also would argue, of course, it's the righteous thing to do.
The spirit of John Murtha. John Murtha is very much a supporter of the military. He's a close friend of the Pentagon. Many people think that he's speaking sort of as a surrogate for some of the top generals who are afraid they can't succeed in the Pentagon. How far do you want to go with the spirit of John Murtha in the form of a candidate for president, for example?
Well, we're talking about the Iraq war here, and that's the debate that's facing the country. John Murtha realizes that the war in Iraq is making America less safe, and that's why he's speaking out. He's worried about our national security. Certainly, if you look at the presidential landscape, there's a lot of candidates who could move an anti-war message in 2008, but that could be Russ Feingold. It could be John Edwards. But really, for 2006, the question is, this is Iraq. The war in Iraq is the number one thing driving people's perceptions that this country is headed on the wrong track. That is what's driving the demand for change from the American people. If Democrats can speak to a change direction on Iraq, the American public will respond to them. But if they support the failed policies of the Bush administration, the public won't respond to them.
Tom Matzie, Washington director of the liberal organization MoveOn.org. Let me go back to Michael Crowley, the senior editor at the New Republic, with his zoological guide. You mentioned John Murtha as a climate-altering asteroid event. A lot of attention has been focused on Hillary Clinton, who put out an email to her supporters pretty much on the eve of the president's speech at the military academy. Consequently, didn't get a lot of attention. She didn't make a statement, didn't hold a news conference or anything like that. What was in that email, and where does it position her in this spectrum of Democrats on the war?
Well, the email was very critical of the president's management of the war, but it did not go so far as to endorse the really sort of high-speed withdrawal position that you've seen Democrats like Murtha and Nancy Pelosi and others take. I mean, one gets the sense that Hillary Clinton really does believe that it's important to have some patience and to try to make Iraq stable, and that's worth a longer sacrifice. But she's facing enormous pressure from the party's liberal base to take a more liberal position. I think that email was sort of an attempt to acknowledge to people she understands their frustration and the pressure she's feeling, and she, not quite in these words, but more or less said that she believes that the war was a mistake to begin with, but I think still is trying to convey a sense that it's very important that the United States leave something behind in Iraq that is not total anarchy and the sort of nightmare scenarios of terrorist havens that you hear about. My sense is that that's what she really believes.
You say she might be hinting that she thinks the war was a mistake, but she has said again and again and again, I don't regret my vote allowing the president to have the authority to conduct the war. One of the problems confronted, of course, by Senator Kerry when he was running for election last year.
That's right. It's a strange kind of semantic game that these Democrats play, where they don't like to say, I voted the wrong way, but they kind of do everything they can in their power to build a sort of rhetorical scaffolding around that, which says, this thing was a mistake, but not quite to say, I voted the wrong way. But I think that I don't remember the exact language from the email right now, but my recollection is that she went a long way towards saying, knowing what we know now about how the Bush administration was going to execute the war, that it was an ill-advised vote. But she has not, you're right, she's not come out and said it in that language.
Michael Crowley with the New Republic. Will Marshall is president of the Progressive Policy Institute, long associated with the centrist wing of the Democratic Party. And Will Marshall, it's always good to have you with us.
Hey, Warren.
Where were you when Gene McCarthy was running in 1968?
I was sort of getting ready to get into college and watching, fascinated, as the Democratic Party melted down that year. I was really a Bobby Kennedy supporter, so I was happy to see Gene McCarthy sort of clear the way for Bobby Kennedy, but not actually wind up with the nomination. A lot of people felt that he was more effective, as a catalyst of change and as a protest candidate than as somebody who could really lead the Democratic coalition to a victory.
Well, where are you now as far as the anti-war movement, some call it? Tom Manci says it's not just a movement anymore, it's really the public. How's the Democratic Party doing in terms of lining itself up on this issue?
Well, I think the important thing for Democrats to do is to keep their eye on the nation's interest. What is the outcome that we need and that we should hold George Bush accountable for bringing about? And put partisanship to one side right now, because the public's deeply anxious about what's going on in Iraq. They have lost all confidence in the Bush administration's handling of the situation there, and they're looking for assurances that we can get out with honor and with success defined as not leaving behind a security nightmare. And I think that's where most Americans are. That's where most Democrats are. They want to try to hold the administration's feet to the fire and say, what are the benchmarks toward progress, toward a extrication from Iraq, but not one that is
right.
So hasty that we are going to be less safe than we are today.
All right. To get out with honor, reminiscent of the phrase peace with honor, used by the man who won in 1968, Richard Nixon. We'll come back, talk to Will Marshall and other guests in just a moment on Reporter's Notebook. Can global warming be slowed in time? On To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're Warren Aldi, back with To the Point. Once again, Gene McCarthy, former senator from Minnesota, died over the weekend, and we're looking at his experience in American politics, his contribution to American politics, if that's a better way to put it, and to the peace movement, particularly in the Democratic Party, looking as to whether there are analogies or otherwise in the current situation with the war on Iraq becoming less popular as time goes on. Talking now with Will Marshall, president of the Progressive Policy Institute, not even in college when Gene McCarthy was running, but a supporter of Robert Kennedy. You said that at that time you were watching as a sort of student as the Democratic Party melted down. One person we haven't mentioned so far today on this program is Joe Lieberman, Democratic senator from Connecticut, former candidate for vice president of the party, who's very supportive of the president and the war in Iraq. So we have all of these gradations, as Michael Crowley was saying earlier. Is there a meltdown going on now in the Democratic Party?
Well, I hope not, Warren. I think that's the thing to be avoided here. You know, right now, as some of the guests have pointed out, the public is really properly focused on George Bush's mishandling of this war, the incredible lack of planning for what came after the actual fighting stopped, the whole nation-building project that he's bungled. And I think it's really important that, you know, Democrats unite around the proposition that he has to bring this policy to a successful conclusion. And not around the idea that we have to get out as fast as we can, even if that risk the kind of security nightmare that many of the Democrats who are in the center on this debate are worried about.
You mentioned earlier that the Democrats ought to be holding the president's feet to the fire. Michael Crowley said that many in the party are playing a sort of rhetorical game. Is that in part because the Democrats have been, for so long, particularly since Vietnam, accused by the Republicans of being weak on national security?
Sure, that's always in the background. Keep in mind that, to your question earlier with Michael, a majority of Democratic senators did vote to authorize the president to go to war. And obviously a lot of them are under great pressure for having done that from folks who avoided the war from the get-go. But the important thing is that public opinion, which supported the war at the beginning, has been a very accurate barometer of conditions on the ground in Iraq. And since they haven't improved, the public has lost a lot of confidence in this policy. And so at the same time, the public has not supported calls for immediate withdrawal. I've never seen a poll that showed that option getting more than, say, 20% of the vote. So most of the Democrats are where most of the people are, between the Bush claim that we just need to stay the course and things are working fine and the insurgency is always on its last legs, which nobody believes anymore, and the idea that you got to get out as soon as possible, regardless of our commitments to the people of Iraq and the safety of our country, should Iraq become a kind of a terrorist base camp once we leave.
Will Marshall, president of the Centrist Progressive Policy Institute. Back to Tom Matzey, Washington director of the liberal group MoveOn.org. You're quoted in the Washington Post this morning as saying that Hillary Clinton's position on this demonstrates cowardice. What do you mean?
Well, I think what Americans want now is leadership. And you can't be afraid of the right-wing talk radio and the Republican noise machine. They're going to keep attacking. And too many Democrats in Washington are not putting forward real leadership and not positing a vision for how America can get out of Iraq, as Congressman John Murtha has done, as some other Democrats in Congress have done. And the choice is between more John Murthas or a position that you can barely explain. That conversation you had with Michael Crowley about Hillary Clinton's email, it was indecipherable what her position was on Iraq. And we can't have leaders who are going to be a weather vane if they want to protect America. People need to posit a vision for what they're going to do. And here's why it's really important for the Democrats. They do not have a historical record of demonstrated strength on national security. So on Social Security, for example, they're in the catbird seat. The public knows they can trust them on Social Security. And so they don't have to posit, a competing plan with the president because, the public knows that they can trust the Democrats on Social Security. That's not the case on national security issues or Iraq. The public doesn't have that historical connection with the Democrats on national security. So the Democrats have to articulate a very clear position where they stand on the most pressing national security issue of our day, which is Iraq, and then a real plan for how they will make America safe once we get out of Iraq, which means refocusing on, homeland security, focusing on, all of the things that the president has neglected over the last couple years, 9/11 Commission recommendations, et cetera.
Tom Matzey with MoveOn.com. Still with us, Professor Stephen Smith at Washington University in St. Louis. A couple of interesting things have come up, it seems to me. We mentioned John Murtha, who, of course, has these long ties with the Pentagon. Does his opposition and his stridency about it and his call for a withdrawal sooner rather than later provide a kind of cover for Democrats for that charge by the Republicans that they're weak on national security?
It sure does. And that's why our circumstances now are so different than they were in 67 and 68. There, the attack on Lyndon Johnson was from the left. It was from within his own party. This is John Murtha, a centrist to conservative on defense issues, attacking presidents of the opposite party. And it has at least opened the door for more vocal criticism from Democrats. Now, we're going to hear a variety of Democratic voices, from Murtha's to Hillary Clinton's to Lieberman's. But that door now is more widely opened, and it's getting media coverage in a way it wasn't before Murtha spoke.
Well, what about Lieberman? So supportive of the president that he is cited in speeches by Vice President Cheney and the president himself, and there's been a rumor that, which he stridently denies, that he might become the next Secretary of Defense. What's that doing to the Democratic argument?
Well, I don't know where Lieberman stands. I guess I think that Lieberman's taking a position that reflects his own personal point of view, and he's not really too worried about the political consequences. I do know that the criticism of Hillary Clinton from the left, like MoveOn.org and so on, actually plays into her hands. She wants to be able to go into the 2008 election with some room to maneuver, and looking like she's not a pansy of the left. So this is actually, I think, doing her a lot of good. I think the quote you pointed out from the Washington Post today plays right into her hands.
Tom Mancey with MoveOn.org, are you playing into her hands?
Senator Clinton is a leader on a whole range of issues, but the point is that we need more leadership. It's that we don't need vacillating, I'm afraid of my shadow, rhetoric on Iraq. Americans want to know what you're going to – the number one question from Americans is when we're going to get out of Iraq. They're not interested in what your plan is for troop levels in the Anbar province, right? They want to know when the troops are coming home, and you have to posit a position on that to demonstrate leadership. I'm not, saying that we would never support Hillary Clinton. She is a great leader on a range of issues. But she needs to lead on Iraq, too, and that's why I made that comment.
Tom Mancey with MoveOn.org. Will Marshall, back to you with the Progressive Policy Institute. You say the polls show that the people are kind of vacillating around in the middle. Is that, though, necessarily then the right strategy or the right posture for a candidate? What about Tom Mancey's insistence that it be clear and certain and have a plan, be ready to go?
Well, it's ironic, really. I think that Hillary Clinton's fairly clear. She says, "Look, I voted for this thing. They mishandled it badly, but we can't cut and run before we've achieved something like stability there that's going to ensure we don't get hit by terrorist strikes from Iraq." Nothing too complicated or ambiguous about that. And for my money, that's exactly what she should be saying. And I'm also struck by how our friends on the anti-war side have gone after Joe Lieberman. There's nothing vacillating about Joe Lieberman's position, and regardless of what you may think about it. I'm actually a lot closer, I think, to Senator Clinton's view. But, he's acting. I know the man, and I can tell you he's acting out of conviction. He's not a weather vane. He's not being blown hither and yon by public opinion. He's trying to put party over country as he sees it. He's trying to say we need to resurrect the old tradition of bipartisanship at a time when the country's at war. Now, he could be more critical of the Bush administration's failures, in my judgment, but let's not pretend that this is vacillation. He's acting with conviction, and yet there are folks who are now they're talking about running primary opponents against him and try to, in effect, run him out of the Democratic Party. I think we need to take a deep breath, understand there's going to be a diversity of views in the Democratic Party, have respect for people who don't share our exact position, and keep in mind that this is George Bush's responsibility. It's his mistake. It's his blunders that have gotten us into the fix we're in. Let's keep the pressure on him to either bring about a successful outcome or take the consequences.
Yeah, Will Marshall at the Progressive Policy Institute. Next question, though, of course, is don't you have to have some alternative rather than just a criticism of the president? That's really what we're talking about today, is what is the Democratic alternative going to look like? And this debate is on. Michael Crowley, back to you at the New Republic. Your magazine editorially supported the war initially, traditionally Democratic-oriented magazine. It's been difficult for us to find Democrats supportive of the war any longer. There seems to be a considerable amount of backing away from that position. What about it? Is Senator Lieberman, as far as the party's concerned, getting isolated?
He is, absolutely. And it's true what you say about the magazine. I can't speak for our sort of editorial position writ large, but I can say that,
I think it's fair to say we followed a similar trajectory, which is a certain disillusionment about the war's execution in particular. And Democrats who did support the war have been isolated and have felt quite a lot of heat from people who opposed the war and in many ways, had better predictions. Lieberman is terribly isolated right now. I don't know what the long-term effects will be. I have to say that even if you don't agree with him, it's a funny thing. People complain constantly that politics is driven by polls and that people just kind of go with the winds. And here's a case where, he obviously really believes in this. And I think, he's taking an incredible amount of heat. Most of his colleagues are playing these kind of cartoonish rhetorical games and saying, woulda, coulda, shoulda. And he's not. And I think that regardless of what you think on the substance, you have to kind of admire his willingness to stand his ground right now, but he's certainly paying for it.
Michael Crowley with The New Republic. Back to Professor Stephen Smith, with whom we started at Washington University in St. Louis. Cartoonish rhetorical games on the one hand, says Michael Crowley. Tom Mancey says it's time to be certain. Will Marshall says Hillary Clinton at least already is. What are the chances, do you think, that the Democratic Party will melt down, as Will Marshall said it did, I think, authoritatively in 1968?
Very little. They have a common opponent in President Bush and the in-power Republicans, and their aim is to win the 2006 and 2008 elections. And I think most Democrats, though not all, think that the 2006 elections will be won by allowing every Democrat to fashion a position on Iraq and other issues as they see fit, as fits their own circumstances. And ultimately, the Democratic position on the war and other things in the next presidential contest will be determined by the winner, not by party honchos, members of Congress, the chairman of the DNC. It's going to be determined by the winner.
You mentioned the chairman of the DNC, Howard Dean. We haven't mentioned him, but he has come out very much on the get out now side of the argument. Professor Smith, that could help or hurt his authority with other Democrats.
Well, I think it's already hurt. I think he's been taken to the woodshed, maybe with a kind slap on the wrist by Senator Reid this past week. I don't think we're going to see a lot more from Dean on that subject. Reid and I think most congressional Democrats want policy pronouncements to be coming from Capitol Hill and not from the DNC headquarters.
On the other hand, Senator Reid reportedly also called Senator Lieberman, told him to stop being so supportive of the president. So it goes with the Democratic Party as we go into a midterm election year, with everybody, of course, talking about the implications for the next presidential election in 2008. Thanks to all of you, Professor Stephen Smith, Washington University, St. Louis, Will Marshall, president of the Progressive Policy Institute, Tom Matzey, Washington director of MoveOn.org, Michael Crowley, congressional reporter, senior editor for The New Republic magazine. Good to have all of you on our program. The Bush administration made the U.S. the odd man out at last week's U.N. climate change conference in Montreal, but other nations, China and India included, are no more eager than America is to make cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. Meantime, scientists say there's no time to waste. More in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Kyoto Protocol was signed in 1997, requiring wealthy countries to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. So far, it's failed to make much of a difference. Only this year was it ratified by enough nations to take effect, with the U.S. famously no longer a party, even though it's the biggest emitter of all. Myra Niebel is Director of Global Warming and Environmental Policy for the business-oriented Competitive Enterprise Institute. Myra Niebel, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
James Hansen, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, has said this very recently, quoted in this context having to do with the Montreal conference that just ended, business as usual will result in so much warming as to constitute a different planet. A lot of people are blaming business interests in the United States for that, for persuading the Bush administration to back away from the Kyoto Protocol. What do you say?
Well, I think that, in fact, the response in all the developed countries is rather similar. there's a lot of talk, but there's very little action. The United States, as you said, is the odd man out because we have refused to ratify the U.S. Senate has not ratified the Kyoto Treaty. But if you look in terms of
Didn't the Bush administration pull it away and take it out of contention?
Neither President Clinton nor President Bush was willing to submit it to the Senate. But even if they did, and I would encourage the president to send it up this week, it would be defeated overwhelmingly. So if you look at emissions growth, the baseline year is 1990. The United States is actually sort of in the middle of the pack of the rich industrialized nations. For example, our emissions have gone up 13% since 1990. Canadian emissions have gone up 24%, but they're all in favor of Kyoto. Similarly, Southern Europe, Spain is over 40%, Portugal's over 30%, Italy's over 20%, and we could go on. Denmark is way up. So these countries are that meet every year for these global warming meetings are determined rhetorically that this is a huge problem that has to be addressed. But in terms of actually doing anything, a lot of them are doing less than the United States.
One of the explanations that's given for that, and one that's given by the Bush administration, I don't know that the Clinton administration gave the same one, but correct me if I'm wrong, is that the major non-industrial nations left out in 1997 are coming on very strong, India and China being primary among them, and they don't want to even talk about capping their emissions, much less cutting them back, because they're looking at economic development. How important are they in this international equation?
Well, I think if you believe that global emissions need to be cut, and you look at the fact that Europe and Japan and Canada, which are all part of Kyoto, are not doing it, then I think the conclusion I would draw is if the richest countries in the world can't do it, how can a poor developing nation like India, where an awful lot of people, hundreds of millions of people there, still don't have access to electricity, they're still burning brush and cow dung to cook their daily meals, how can they sign on to emissions cuts when they have this desperate energy poverty? So I think that basically reality is catching up to Kyoto. They do a lot of talk. In fact, President Clinton spoke there on Friday. I thank goodness I left Thursday night. I left Montreal Thursday night to come back to Washington. But I think he got it about right on Friday. He said, you know, the problem with Kyoto is you guys talk a good game, but you don't actually do anything.
Are we then, to be realistic, confronting what James Hansen, director of the Goddard Institute, says, that we're going to see a very different planet?
Well, I don't know what to make of Dr. Hansen. His rhetoric, since he sort of got this thing going when he testified before a hearing chaired by Senator Al Gore in 1988, and he said, we know it's happening, we can judge the magnitude of it. And, of course, his original prognostication has proved to be wildly inaccurate. His rhetoric seems to be quite wild, and his research actually seems to suggest quite moderate warming. And if you look at some of the conclusions in his papers, you'll see that his actual scientific predictions are much more modest and predict much less warming than his sort of wild public utterances. So I really don't know what to make of him.
Myron Ebell, Director of Global Warming and International Environmental Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Jeff Fiedler is Climate Policy Specialist at the National Resources Defense Council, previously was a consultant on global warming for the Environmental Protection Agency. Jeff Fiedler, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What about it? As Myron Ebell says, as he says President Clinton said, is it all rhetoric and no action?
I think that's a pretty misleading and unfair characterization of what other countries are doing. Myron forgot to point out one pretty important thing, that the European Union, 25 member states, have mandatory domestic limits on their emissions. They have an operating market-based flexible cap-and-trade system, and they are clearly taking this a lot more seriously than the U.S. administration is, with their reliance on voluntary measures and just long-term technology R&D.
Well, wait a minute, though. Since 1990, according to Mr. Ebell, the U.S. emissions have gone up by 13%. Europe's have gone on up between 30 and 40%.
Well, he was pointing to just one or two of the 25 European countries that everyone has known for 10 years
have much higher growth rates. He was looking at Spain, Portugal, and Italy. When you look at the 25 countries as a whole, their emissions are stabilizing and going down, and they are, in fact, on track to meet their 2008 to 2012 Kyoto Protocol targets.
Regardless of what the economic consequences might be?
Well, I wouldn't say regardless. They view the investment in new energy technologies as a positive for them. They see themselves as getting ahead of the curve on the technologies we need to deal with energy security issues, with global warming, and also with sustainable development in developing countries.
What do you think about the aftermath of the Montreal conference? Went on for 2 weeks. The New York Times, for example, says that all that happened were modest last-minute agreements to keep talking.
Well, you know, I think that is a harsh characterization. To me, this was a very important political signal that the Kyoto Coalition of the Willing, if you will, have in place now a roadmap for the second phase of Kyoto. Kyoto is up and running now, and developed and developing countries are now at the table, ready to begin the what everyone knows will be a difficult 2 to 3 year negotiating process. That is progress. Do we have the table, the roadmap, the process ready to go?
Does that include India and China?
It does. It includes India, China, and in fact, the entire G77 group of developing countries are all part of this Kyoto Protocol negotiations that has now been teed up and ready to go.
So the goal of the Kyoto Protocol is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's to reduce emissions to where they were in 1990. You're saying that's achievable? That might happen by when?
The first phase of the Kyoto Protocol is for 30-some developed countries to reduce their emissions 5% below 1990 levels in the 2008 to 2012 timeframe.
And do you think that's going to happen?
I do. And all the developed countries have in place domestic plans. A lot of them recognize that those plans still need some additional elements, but they are fully committed to doing that. So the Kyoto Protocol first phase is up and running, and the second step, as I said, has now been teed up, ready to begin negotiating that, so it'll be in place when we need it in 2012.
What about the United States then?
Well, I mean, I think the U.S. Really misplayed its hand here and showed themselves to be as isolated internationally as they are domestically on how to responsibly deal with the issue of global warming. They objected coming in to having any kind of dialogue whatsoever on this issue internationally. To me, that's just irresponsible. And at the end, they basically had to give ground and agree because they saw that the rest of the world was united moving forward on Kyoto. Okay. And those countries left the door open for a more informal dialogue with the U.S. as well.
All right. Jeff Fiedler, again, with the National Resources Defense Council. Let me go back to Myron Ebell with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. What do you say? Is the United States going, as I think Jeff Fiedler is suggesting, to be dragged, kicking and screaming by its heels into the same kinds of reductions that you described as all talk and no action?
I doubt it, but I'd begin that by saying it simply isn't true that European countries, Japan and Canada, are on track to meet their commitments. The European Environment Agency, right before the Montreal talks, put out a study saying that they will meet their targets with additional measures. Well, these additional measures turn out to be pretty severe if you actually look at the emissions growth in many European countries. And Even in a fairly stagnant economy like Japan, their emissions growth is fairly similar to ours since 1990. So these are going to require very severe measures, and I don't think there's the political will in Europe, even in Britain, which is one of two countries that's really on track to meet its target.
If that's true, let me go back to Jeff Fiedler with the National Resources Defense Council. Let's concede the argument for a moment. What would that mean in terms of global warming, in terms of James Hansen, whom Myron Ebell is questioning, says will lead to a different planet?
Well, if I understand your question, you're asking, you know, what will happen if it turns out to be phenomenally expensive to make the steep emission cuts?
And they aren't made. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if that turns out to be true, and I mean, I would dispute that. I think that's not what we're seeing as Kyoto parties begin to implement their commitments. I mean, if it turns out to be very expensive, then, you know, there will be, you know, political trade-offs that are made between the cost of adaptation to the consequences of climate change and investing in reducing emissions.
Okay.
Right now, I think we should give reducing emissions a shot, you know, and see what we can do with these new energy technologies and the new markets they're creating.
All right. Sorry we have to leave it at that, but we got two very different views of the current situation with regarding Kyoto and the UN conference. We'll have you both back on future programs. So Jeff Fiedler with the National Resources Defense Counselor, Myron Ebell with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Thanks for being with us.
Today's program
produced by Francis Anderton with Karen Radziner and Katie Cooper, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.